From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the botched execution of an Oklahoma inmate ignites debate over the controversial cocktail of drugs being used to end the life of death row prisoners.
At 6:39, he's still lifting his shoulders and head off the gurney, grimacing, and appeared to be in distress.
Also today, the uncertain fate of over 200 abducted Nigerian schoolgirls amid unconfirmed reports they've been forced to marry Islamist extremists. And a cloud of uncertainty hangs over the future of US ties with Egypt.
We shouldn't be giving money to a military takeover of a government, and we certainly shouldn't be giving any money to people who do mass trials and convict 683 people in a trial and condemn them to death.
That's coming up on FSN Reports. After a summary of our latest news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Daniel Renches. Gerry Adams, the leader of Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, has been arrested in Northern Ireland in connection with a 1972 murder. Mr. Adams' arrest came shortly after he voluntarily went to a police station for questioning. From FSN's London Bureau, Ollie Barrett reports.
In a statement, Gerry Adams says that his meeting with the PSNI has been voluntary. He says that the killing of Jean McConville was wrong and a grievous injustice to her and her family. He says in the statement he's never disassociated himself from the IRA, but is innocent of any part in the abduction, killing or burial of Mrs. McConville.
The governor of Oklahoma has ordered an independent review into the state's use of the death penalty following a botched execution in the state on Tuesday night. Clayton Lockett died of a heart attack after an attempt to execute him using lethal injection was abandoned. The White House has criticized the episode, as our Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Amid a growing sense of outrage over the events in Oklahoma's death chamber, the White House says the execution of Clayton Lockett fell short of humane standards. Now, Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon has bowed to mounting pressure and ordered a full independent review of her state's execution procedures. Clayton Lockett's execution was abandoned 20 minutes after it began when one of his veins ruptured. He died of a heart attack sometime after witnesses were barred from seeing what was taking place in the death chamber. Capital punishment opponents have seized on the case, saying it shows the death penalty is cruel and unusual, and therefore unconstitutional. Simon Marks, Washington.
Wall Street closed at an all-time high at the end of Wednesday trading in New York. From FSN's business desk, Nick Harper reports.
In the last 2 hours of trading, the markets rallied, the Dow Jones in particular, rising 46 points or 0.3% to end the day at a new record high. That was after the Federal Reserve announced it was reducing its stimulus program by another $10 billion a month, cropping the amount of bonds it buys every month to $45 billion worth. Wall Street seemed to take on some of the optimism showed by the Federal Reserve. The Fed deciding to reduce the stimulus program despite weak economic data during the first 3 months of the year. Nick Harper, New York.
The British actor Bob Hoskins is being mourned by moviegoers and his fellow actors alike. He died on Wednesday at the age of 71, following a long battle with Parkinson's disease. Bob Hoskins found fame in the BBC series Pennies from Heaven and starred in Mona Lisa, The Long Good Friday, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The human rights chief of the United Nations, Navi Pillay, has accused both government and rebel forces in South Sudan of using child soldiers. The UN estimates that over 9,000 children have taken part in the conflict since fighting broke out in December. William Denslow reports from the United Nations in New York.
Speaking at the end of a visit to South Sudan, Navi Pillay accused rebels and those loyal to the president of recruiting child soldiers, as well as indiscriminate attacks on civilians and children. With over 1 million people displaced in the country, she says there's a real threat of famine and that leaders are showing an apparent lack of concern. A truce signed in January has done little to stop the five-month conflict. Indeed, violence has escalated in recent weeks, with reports of ethnically motivated mass killings of civilians. United States Secretary of State John Kerry is travelling to Ethiopia to try and broker a peace deal between both sides.
Spanish police say they've arrested a man they suspect threw a banana at Barcelona football player Dani Alves during a La Liga match in Spain. The racist gesture sparked outrage and a massive online social media campaign. Here's our Europe reporter, Jack Parrock.
Barcelona left-back Dani Alves says he's been denouncing racist gestures like this one for 6 years. So when the banana was thrown at him in Sunday's match against Villarreal, he picked it up and ate it whole. The Twitter hashtag #WeAreAllMonkeys then surged with famous people and football fans alike posting photos and videos of themselves eating bananas to the social media site. Police in Spain say they've now arrested a man named locally as 26-year-old David Campaya Leo, a Villarreal supporter. The club has already rescinded his season ticket and given him a lifetime ban, but he could now face criminal charges.
And that's the latest feature story news. Daniel Wrenches reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
At 6:39, he's still lifting his shoulders and head off the gurney, grimacing, and appeared to be in distress.
Eyewitness accounts of the botched execution of Oklahoma inmate Clayton Lockett, who was pronounced dead by doctors 45 minutes after the lethal injection process got underway. The White House also expressed concern over the incident.
We have a fundamental standard in this country that even when the death penalty is justified, it must be carried out humanely.
Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallin has ordered an investigation into Lockett's death and stayed the execution of a second death row inmate for 14 days. For more insight on the use of lethal injection, I spoke to Fordham Law's Deborah Deno, one of the nation's foremost experts on the death penalty.
My reaction was two parts. I mean, on the one hand, I was incredibly surprised because Oklahoma was so aware that everyone in the world was going to be watching this execution, and that they were under pressure to carry it out the best way they possibly could. So we know whatever happened last night was their very best job. So on the other hand, given all the medical and legal warnings about these drugs and what Oklahoma was doing and its how much secrecy it was engaging in, you know, we could maybe on the one, you know, we could sense that this wasn't such a surprise.
Why has Oklahoma shrouded the cocktail of drugs in such secrecy? Why do we not know who's manufacturing these and supplying these drugs for this purpose?
Well, Oklahoma puts these drugs or shrouds these drugs in secrecy as a number of other states do, because they know that the more information that's revealed about what they're doing with the lethal injection procedures, the more problematic the public is going to know it is. And because every time a Department of Corrections really goes through and explains in detail what they're doing, there's always a problem with it.
And in the case of this death row inmate, Mr. Lockett, something obviously went awry, and it was a long and agonizing death by eyewitness accounts anyway. Can you explain, in theory, what was supposed to happen with this three-stage injection execution?
Well, in theory, what's supposed to happen is you have three drugs. The first drug, the midazolam, was supposed to have made Mr. Lockett unconscious. While he's unconscious, he would be injected with the second drug, which is a paralytic agent, which is highly controversial, by the way, because it really, the sole purpose is to paralyze the inmate so that inmate doesn't try to talk or to move around or grimace, etc. And then the third drug is the potassium chloride, which induces cardiac arrest. So under a perfectly performed lethal injection, the inmate would be unconscious and then would be injected with the second and third drugs, all the while never experiencing any kind of pain that those drugs could inflict. And then the lethal injection would take about 4 minutes. That's certainly not what happened here.
What happened here appears to have been a cruel and unusual punishment. Does this mean that Mr. Lockett's death and the actions of Oklahoma were unconstitutional, in your opinion?
We don't have enough information, I think, at this point to come to a conclusion on whether or not his death was unconstitutional. There's so many questions left open.
But certainly we could assume that his death was an agonizing one.
I think you could assume that this death was never supposed to happen, And I you know, just based on the facts, if I think you can assume that the execution was never supposed to have lasted this long. He was never supposed to have indications of consciousness, which he did have. He tried to speak. He tried to get up. He was never to have indications that he was experiencing pain in the way that he did. And I know of no execution of which I am aware where the inmate ultimately died from a cardiac arrest in the way that they're reporting, from a heart attack.
The idea of lethal injection first came up in the 1800s. Why today, 2014, are there still mistakes when it comes to carrying out executions of death row inmates?
I think it's important to realize with a lethal injection execution that it's a punishment. This is not a hospital procedure. Mm. You're not taking an inmate into a surgery room and having an anesthesiologist sit next to that inmate's side watching every movement and regulating the drugs and inspecting the drugs and having an open and transparent procedure. This is a secret procedure. It's being conducted by people who may not be very well trained. That's the assumption. And in a setting that does not invite a quick and painless procedure.
Mm-hmm. What needs to happen in the United States to bring an end to this record of bungled executions?
Well, in 1890 in this country, when we were considering whether or not to adopt electrocution, and New York State was the lead state on that matter, the governor of New York appointed a commission of three individuals who, for the next 2 years, looked at every execution procedure that was taking place in the world. They did a huge amount of research. Of course, it was 1890, and what they came up with, that being electrocution, was problematic in and of itself. But we've never even attempted to do something like that in this country. The United Kingdom certainly did. In the 1950s, they appointed a board of individuals, a panel of people, to look very closely at their death penalty process, not just how they executed people, but all the other problems associated with it. The percentage of innocence people, the racial disparities, the poor lawyering, the fact that inmates are disproportionately low socioeconomic status, etc. And we've never attempted to do anything in this country. It's always rush to execute.
Fordham Law's Deborah Denno. This is FSN Reports. Washington is playing host this week to Egypt's foreign minister as the fate of a $1.5 billion military aid package hangs in the balance. The State Department and Pentagon have both pushed for restoring the aid, despite serious concerns around press freedom and human rights. But lawmakers on Capitol Hill aren't so sure. Our correspondent Alice Olstein reports that many key figures on both sides of the aisle say Egypt shouldn't get any US taxpayer money until it frees imprisoned journalists and ends its crackdown on opposition parties.
The foreign minister of Egypt had a mixed reception on Capitol Hill, as many lawmakers publicly criticized the government's recent actions, especially a top Egyptian court sentencing hundreds of people at once to be executed by the state. Though the Obama administration has condemned this action and called on Egypt to stop all mass trials, they've moved forward with requesting more than $1 billion in aid. As the top Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Tennessee's Bob Corker met with Nabil Fahmy Wednesday. Just before, he told FSN he supports approving the aid for strategic reasons.
You know, it's a very important country. I mean, the things they're doing with helicopters in the Sinai Desert are not just important to us, they're important to our friends, Israel and others. So, again, I think, I just think that being involved with folks, when you're concerned about their direction and you're concerned about their stability when they're such an important actor relative to the Middle East, I think you stay engaged. I don't think you throw people aside, you know, when they're going through difficulties. I think you work with them to try to get them in a better place. However, I mean, I realize we're going to be looking at strong conditions relative to aid, relative to what's just happened, okay?
Several Republican hawks, including John McCain and Lindsey Graham, agreed, though Graham characterized Egypt as a coup government that's on the road to being Algeria. But many lawmakers in both parties remain strongly opposed.
We shouldn't be giving money to a military takeover of a government, and we certainly shouldn't be giving any money to people who do mass trials and convict 683 people in a trial and condemn them to death.
That's Kentucky Republican Rand Paul, who sits on the committee that holds the purse strings for U.S. foreign aid. He told FSN he will soon introduce legislation to stop the approval of the money slated for Egypt. But the Pentagon gave FAMI a rare honor cordon welcome this week and confirmed they plan to send Egypt 10 Apache attack helicopters, a step that doesn't require approval from Congress. And when FAMI met with Secretary John Kerry at the State Department Tuesday, there was no public mention of the death sentences or Egypt's recent move to outlaw the April 6th movement, a youth group that played a key role in the 2011 uprising. After joking about FAMI's New York upbringing, Kerry vowed the U.S. will continue to support its strategic relationship with Egypt, despite concerns.
What happens in the next weeks and months is very, very important to all of us. We want the interim government to be successful. We are hopeful and look for a political process of inclusivity, a constitution implemented, which brings people politically to the table and broadens the democratic base of Egypt. Egypt's constitution is a positive step forward. It has taken steps, and they are moving now to an election. But even as these positive steps have been taken, we all know there have been disturbing decisions within the judicial process, the court system, that have raised serious challenges for all of us.
But some on Capitol Hill blasted the State Department's posture, including Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy.
We can't stand here and say, golly, gee whiz, we're kind of disturbed by hundreds of people being sentenced to death after a few minutes in a mass trial, but actually, we've been friends for so long, we'll send you some money, but you should stop doing that.
With a major election in Egypt next month, the U.S. government has to decide whether it will deliver the $1.5 billion in aid that has gone to the nation every year for decades. Over the next few weeks, the White House will attempt to convince Leahy and other skeptical lawmakers that the U.S. will have more leverage for its demands, such as releasing imprisoned reporters and reprieving condemned activists, if it keeps the money flowing. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, hundreds of protesters have marched through the Nigerian capital demanding the release of over 200 schoolgirls abducted by militants earlier this month. At the same time, unconfirmed reports surface that the girls have been forced to marry Nigerian Islamists. The government has so far offered little official response to the incident or a potential rescue operation. The extremist group Boko Haram has been blamed for the mass kidnapping which took place 2 weeks ago in the country's restive northeastern region. FSN's Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso discussed the abduction with me earlier.
Well, even though those reports can't really be substantiated, the issue of being forced to marry is probably in line with some of the local practices that have been going on for many years, and in as much that it is a completely and totally Muslim-dominated area, and where men are obviously allowed to have more than two or three wives. So it's not uncommon for young schoolgirls to be married off to older men, but in this case, obviously, quite outraged because the whole issue of kidnapping girls and taking them to villages in nearby towns or nearby areas where they often get married off to older men or to men in the area where there might be a shortage of women is not uncommon. But in this case, because of the insurgents allegedly behind all these kidnappings, and it's not yet been confirmed, by the way, but even with that hanging over this entire process, it has caused quite some outrage from the mothers of those girls who would really just want to know where the girls are, because they've not had any word from either the government or from any other forces for that matter about what really happened to those girls.
Gary, is it unusual to have almost radio silence from the government in terms of what's happened and what's taken place, Or does this signify how lawless that area of Nigeria has become?
Very difficult to put your finger on this one, because it is unheard of for the government to remain silent so long. It's 2 weeks now, silent so long on what is a very, very emotional issue, not only for the parents, but Nigerians as far south as Lagos, Christian and Muslim faiths put aside. People are outraged that insurgents were allowed to come in the middle of the night, or the middle of the day in this case, round up more than 200 schoolgirls, put them on open trucks and buses and drive them off into the bush, and who knows what happened. So at the end of the day, outrage. Not only from the parents who have already spoken on this issue, but it also speaks perhaps of a slightly broader issue, and this is that there is so much that the security forces have their hands full in Borno, that's the northeastern state where this kidnapping happened, that it's difficult for them to perhaps put their finger on one single incident because they're fighting it on so many fronts. These Boko Haram insurgents coming from across the border from Niger and Chad and even northern Cameroon. So very difficult.
FSN's Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso. Now, Colorado Springs Gazette journalist David Phillips was recently awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in National Reporting for his series Other Than Honorable. It tells the story of US soldiers returning from combat who are then discharged for so-called misconduct, for relatively minor violations. The discharge leaves the soldiers without medical benefits, even though many of them suffer from traumatic physical and psychological conditions. FSN's Mary McCarthy met up with David Phillips in Denver and started by asking him about this fundamental injustice these former soldiers are facing.
Thousands of soldiers are coming back with either a traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorder, or often both, and they're injuries that can't be seen. And oftentimes, the symptoms of them look exactly like misconduct. And so the Army treats it as misconduct because the Army doesn't have the science yet to really tell the difference. And so they say, this soldier's not badly injured, this soldier's just bad. And they punish that soldier by kicking them out of the Army for misconduct. Now, the real tragedy of that is that when they are kicked out, if they're given an other than honorable discharge, they are separated from their veterans' benefits forever. And so what that basically means is the soldiers, the veterans that need these benefits the most, don't get them.
So how much awareness is there among Americans that this is happening to some of our returning soldiers?
There's growing awareness that's happening, but it's taken years and thousands of people going through this situation. In fact, there are Vietnam veterans who are right now suing the government trying to get benefits because the same things happened to them.
David, the soldiers that you profiled were at Fort Carson Army Base here in Colorado. Is this an issue only at Fort Carson, or is it something that's happening nationwide?
It's really difficult for us to distinctly define how much this is happening, because just like the Army, we in the civilian world can't definitively say who is injured and who is not. But when we look at the statistics, what we find is that every year since 2003, basically, more and more soldiers have been kicked out for misconduct, and that rise generally mirrors the rise in wounded. You know, we're having soldiers that are going back for repeated tours, oftentimes are hit by multiple bomb blasts, and so something's got to give. And what we know is that the medical avenue for getting these guys out is clogged, and so this avenue of getting them out through misconduct becomes a much easier option.
David, your series in the Colorado Springs Gazette drew some attention to the plight of these injured veterans who've been discharged without medical benefits, and it did even lead to some of them getting those benefits reinstated. Do you think that now, having won the Pulitzer, that will draw even more attention to this issue?
You know, I never thought I would say this, but the Pulitzer doesn't really matter. The cooler thing that happened is right after I heard that we won the Pulitzer, I got a call from a combat vet who this had happened to in 2007. And he said, I found your series last fall. He lives in New York. I found your series on last fall online, and I started reading it. And I had thought that I was all alone, and I realized that I wasn't, and that there were these thousands of guys that were doing this. And he then very intensely got involved with veterans groups that went to Washington, D.C., you know, with our statistics in hand, and started pushing for Congress to do things to try and help guys out who this has happened to. And they did it. Right now, there's bills pending, sponsored by a number of senators, that these these veterans got started using, he said, essentially, I built the foundation for them to build all of this on. So to hear that and to see these guys take it up and continue forward is really, that's the coolest thing.
FSN's Mary McCarthy, Denver. And finally tonight, the British actor Bob Hoskins, best known for his roles in The Long Good Friday and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, has died at the age of 71. In a statement, his family said he died in hospital following a bout of pneumonia. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead takes a look back at his life and works, both in cinema and television.
Vast British. We used to have a bit more vitality, imagination, touching a Dunkirk spirit, know what I mean?
It was in 1980 that Bob Hoskins had his first major movie breakthrough in The Long Good Friday, his career seeing him play characters from a violent mobster to a scurvy pirate. Born in the east of England on October the 26th, 1942, Hoskins grew up in London and started out on stage before embarking on a career in television and film. In 1978, he starred in the BBC's musical drama serial Pennies from Heaven, for which he was nominated for a television BAFTA.
It's impossible to explain. It's just not the sort of thing that you can put into words.
Oh, yes, it is.
Yes, yes, my baby.
He later won a BAFTA and was Oscar nominated for his role in the 1986 film Mona Lisa, in which he starred opposite Sir Michael Caine and Robbie Coltrane. Hoskins was further propelled into Hollywood fame after playing a detective alongside cartoons in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
You've got the wrong idea about me, Mr. Valiant. I'm a pawn in this, just like Roger. Can you help me find him? Just name your price, and I'll pay it.
Yeah, I bet you would. You gotta have the rabbit to make the scam work.
No.
In 1988, Bob Hoskins described himself as a happy man, explaining why in a BBC radio interview.
Well, two things, I think. If you have a good job and you're happy in your work, most people are very happy to have a career. Or if you have, like, a happy marriage, like, they're very happy to have a happy marriage. That's an element that makes their life worthwhile. I've got both, you know, which is extraordinary.
Bob Hoskins retired from acting in 2012 after revealing he'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. His last film role was as one of the dwarves in Snow White and the Huntsman, starring alongside Christian Stewart, the film released in the same year. Fellow actors have paid tribute to Hoskins, Dame Judi Dench among them, Stephen Fry describing him as a marvellous man. Bob, however, was far more modest about his description.
You don't exactly fulfil the image of a movie star. I think you've described yourself as 5'6" and cubic, and somebody else has said, and I don't think you've disputed it, that you've got a face like a damaged potato. I'm not sure that's true, actually, looking at you across the table today, but it's the sort of thing they say. It's not the kind of sexy movie star image, is it?
Well, whatever descriptions they make, I'm a short, fat, middle-aged man with a broken nose and a bald head. That's me.
The 71-year-old died in hospital, surrounded by his family. Dan Whitehead, London.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com, and follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Thursday, the University of California at Berkeley gets ready to celebrate the legacy of Nelson Mandela. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.